Start time at start time, I guess. Questions about the homework? Yeah, it's actually this pile. So the back in 200, when you're working these same sorts of problems, I bet you worked this problem or one similar to it, and you probably worked out some special geometry that this angle equals that angle, and that's not how I want you to work these problems. I really do want you to set up these problems so that you tell me that r equals whatever it equals, r prime equals whatever it equals, find r minus r prime, find the magnitude of r minus r prime, put it in the denominator and cube it, and do it in exactly the formal way. And the reason is that if you're for a real problem, that is to say one that you can't solve with pencil and paper, you would have to enter this formula into a computer in order to calculate these integrals for you. And you wouldn't be able to use the sort of special geometry situation that that would apply. And there are handouts over there. Hand that back to Taylor. Okay? So what do we do last time? We looked at some special properties of gradient, etc., of the R vector. And the ones that are particularly important are these, that if we take the gradient of 1 over the distance from some fixed point, we get something that looks a whole lot like an electric field. And that if we took the Laplacian of that same quantity, we got 0, except maybe when R equals R prime. And we're going to be try and use pretty systematically the idea that R without a prime on it is where you're trying to observe something, and R with a prime on it is the source of the electric or magnetic field that that you're trying to observe. So we had this formula, which basically goes back to 200 for what the electric field is. The little bit of charge that we're adding up, it might be a volume charge density, it might be a surface charge density, it might be a linear charge density, might be point charges, it might be all of the above, right? One after another, add it all up together, right? So these are just various ways we have of locating charge, and we would just do the corresponding integral if we wanted it. And I've got down here a theorem that I'm sure you proved in calculus long ago called Leibniz's theorem. And it's kind of worth talking about it a little bit because we'll be using it pretty frequently. What we have here is an integral with respect to y. And so once we do that integral, y is going to disappear from the answer. So this thing is just a function of x. And so we can talk about taking the derivative of it with respect to x. And it turns out that if we do the process of doing the integral and then taking the derivative, we get exactly the same thing as we would get if we took the derivative and then calculated the integral. And kind of a technical point, do notice that here I've got a partial derivative because this function depends on two variables, x and y. Here I have a normal old freshman year derivative because this thing doesn't depend on y anymore. The y dependence is gone once I've done the integration. Okay, so that's Leibniz's theorem. So what we have basically talked about here is, given a charge density, how can I get the electric field? And kind of the next step in this is to realize that the integrand that I have for my electric field is pretty much just the gradient of 1 over phi. So that gives me an alternative expression for the electric field, namely that the electric field can be written as 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. And then inside this integrand, I can have minus the gradient of 1 over the magnitude of r minus r prime. And of course, I have to have some charge that I'm adding up. And I can now use Leibniz's theorem kind of in reverse, right? So I have the derivative inside, this is actually, of course, a vector, so I have three of them in a row, but I have the derivative inside the integral, and I can pull that thing out. So this is minus the gradient of 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, add up the little bit of charge divided by the distance we are from that charge. And this quantity here, that's called the voltage, phi. Okay, so what we have here is if you tell me the charge distribution, I can tell you what the voltage is by doing that integral. And if you tell me what phi is, I can get the electric field just by taking the gradient of it. So in the end, we'd like all of these arrows to go both ways. So let's see about whether, given the electric field, we can find out what the voltage is. Okay, so if we do the following, let's integrate up. Now, this is going to be kind of backwards. From the final point to the initial point, the electric field line integral. Okay, so here's the spot, the final value, where I'm trying to find out what the voltage is, and I'm going to do this integral. Since the electric field is minus the gradient of phi, we got that. We can, of course, use the minus sign to switch around the order of integration. And this was one of our standard theorems. This is equal then to the final value of the voltage minus the initial value of the voltage. So if I choose my initial point to be the point where I've defined the voltage to be zero, it's usually called ground. So if I do this integral from the final value to the initial value, by definition, that's zero, so I've got a way of getting the final value of the voltage at that location. Okay, now you might worry that this isn't well defined. What if I choose a different way of getting to ground? Am I going to get a different value for the voltage? Well, I better not, because there's only one value for the voltage at the point F. And we showed that before, right? This integral doesn't depend on the path, it just depends on the endpoints. So any old path that connects the point we're interested in to ground is a way I can calculate the voltage at that particular location. Okay? And it's, I'm sure you know, voltages are a lot easier to measure than electric fields. So most commonly we'll be using voltages for our calculations. The other thing that's important is that if we're going to calculate an electric field, we have to calculate three integrals. Right, because we have to get the x component of the electric field, the y component of the electric field, the z component of the electric field. The voltage is a scalar, so I only have to do one integral. I do have to take the gradient, so it's not, you know, not a pure wind situation, but at least it's a partial wind situation that I've got one integral to do as opposed to three integrals to do. Okay. All right, so let's take a look at a quick example of this. It's not actually do the calculation, but let's say that we wanted that we had a square that goes from minus L to L on both sides, and I'm interested in the voltage along the z-axis. How would I go about doing that? So, starting out as usual, the R location where I'm trying to observe it, it's on the z-axis. Where the charge is, it's on this square, and that square is all in the z equals zero plane. So then I'm supposed to calculate r minus r prime as a vector. So minus x prime minus y prime z. And then I'm supposed to take the magnitude of that vector. So that's easily done, right? X prime squared plus y prime squared plus z squared. And then the voltage is going to be 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. Integrate up, x and y are both going to go from minus L to L. The little bit of charge is going to be the surface charge density times dx dy. And then I just have 1 over this distance. Okay. And Mathematica can, in fact, do that integral. It takes it about 30 minutes. And in the end, of course, it has a conditional expression like you wouldn't believe. But we can get rid of that conditional expression, and we could, in fact, happily get the voltage at that particular location. Okay, so that's how I want you to work these sort of problems. Very similar to the electric fields. Tell me your location. Use symmetry or the problem to define what R is. Here's where my charge is. Calculate what R minus R prime is. Calculate the magnitude of it. Write down the integral, and then pretty often give it to Mathematica in order to come up with the right answer. So we simplify things a little bit, one integral as opposed to three integrals, but these integrals, there aren't a lot of examples that are doable in terms of paper and pencil. So what we'd like to have is some sort of way of getting our voltages without resorting to some sort of numerical process to calculate those integrals. And what we have is what's called the multipole expansion. And this is exactly the sort of thing that physicists love. We know that any measurement we make of an electric field or a voltage is going to have a certain amount of error, so there's no reason to mathematically calculate the 100th decimal place of the voltage. We don't need an exact answer. We just need an answer that's good enough. And of course, you know, maybe we're going to use an expensive voltmeter, so we're going to get more digits. We'd like to have the precision of our mathematics be adjustable, so that if we need 6 digits, well, we'll have to do some more work, but we can get 6 digits one way or the other. And maybe getting 2 digits is going to be a lot easier. And that's what the word expansion has to do. This is going to be a series of terms that you can add up, where the terms get smaller and smaller and smaller, and you can quit whenever you want when you get the required precision. Each one of these terms is going to require us to do an integral, but it's going to be a much simpler integral than these ones that have square roots in them and that sort of stuff. They're more likely to be kind of polynomial sorts of integrals. So the starting point, and you should be hanging on to the handout that looks like that, except it's red, except it's not red. The starting point for the multipole expansion is the Taylor series expansion. And I don't know, you all have forgotten your Taylor series expansion maybe from the past. I like to write down the Taylor series expansion in the following way, because it's, to me at least, it's something I can actually remember. So if I'm interested in 1 minus x to the minus alpha, and that's the hard thing to remember, there are all of those minus signs in it. But the other side of the equation is going to be moderately simple. And what this is, of course, when x is equal to 0, this is just 1. And for small x, this is going to be alpha times x. And for the next order term, it's going to be like that. What's the general term? Well, the general term is going to be building up on alphas. So it's going to be alpha times alpha plus 1 plus alpha times 2. All of those things one after another, and that's called the shifted factorial. It's also named for the famous dead mathematician Pockhammer. And that's what it's called in Mathematica. I like shifted factorial because we don't care about dead mathematicians. We only care about dead physicists. So a factorial function, you know, say 5 factorial, that's something that starts at 1 and then you multiply terms together until you get 5 terms. So the shifted factorial, alpha sub n, doesn't start at 1, it starts at alpha, and then you add 1 to alpha until you have n terms. And if you work that out, that means the last term is going to be alpha plus n minus 1, right? Because we started at 0. So that's pretty easy to calculate. And this Taylor series expansion of this thing can then be written as add up the shifted factorial of alpha divided by n factorial times x to the n. Okay, so let's kind of give an example of this in quasi-real life. So if I look at your homework, I'm looking for your homework, I hope somebody did it right. So the problem of interest is this case of a charged disk where we're finding the electric field on the z-axis. And I see an answer that I think is right, namely that the electric field in the z direction, it's only in the z direction, is equal to the charge density divided by 2 epsilon naught, 1 minus z divided by the square root of z squared plus a squared. Now, without thinking about this too hard, what should be the electric field for large values of z? Well, okay, 0 is an answer, but it's not. I want a closer approximation than that. And I claim that the electric field should be, for large values of z, the charge divided by 4 pi epsilon naught z squared, right? That's certainly what the formula would be if this thing was a point particle. And if I'm a light year away from this disk, it's going to look a whole lot like a point particle. That is to say, the detailed structure of this disk isn't going to matter very much. So presumably, if I put in large values of z into that formula, I should get that formula. So how can we demonstrate that? Well, in order to use this shifted factorial, in order for these terms to be getting smaller, x better be less than 1. So the first thing I need to do is to write this square root of z squared plus a squared as something that is 1 plus something that's small. So if I write z squared plus a squared to the minus 1 half, and I pull out the z, what I'm going to be left with is 1 plus a squared over z squared, all to the minus 1 half. And according to my expansion, alpha is equal to 1 half, and x is equal to minus a squared over z squared. Right? Minus because this guy had a minus sign and this guy has a plus sign. So what this thing should equal then approximately is 1 and then alpha times x. And I'm not going to care about the next term, but let's write. So I wrote alpha, but I might as well write it as a half since that's what alpha is. And then I'm going to have 1 half times 3 halves divided by 2 all times a squared over z squared all quantity squared. Okay, so in order to plug this into my formula, I need to multiply it by z, and I've got a 1 over z there, so that's all going to go along for the ride. So the leading order term for this thing is going to be 1, and I've got 1 minus 1. That's looking good. So what I'm left over with, if we just kind of write it out then, is we've got e in the z direction is sigma over 2 epsilon naught. So we have the 1 minus 1. What we have then is the rest of these terms, which is minus, and again, z over z is going to be 1. So then we've got 1 half times minus a squared over z squared plus more terms. Okay, so let's crank this out a little bit more. So we've got minus a minus is a plus. We've got a half and this 2. So the electric field in the z direction is going to be plus sigma over 4 epsilon naught, and then I've got a squared divided by z squared as my first order approximation. Now if I multiply top and bottom by pi, what I'm going to have here, pi r squared is the area of the circle, and this is the charge per area. So what I'm going to get is the charge divided by 4 pi epsilon naught over z squared. Now it's not going to be exactly that, right, because there are more terms, but to the extent that z is large, those terms are going to be hugely smaller. Right? So this term compared to that term is going to be z squared over a squared over z squared smaller than the previous term. Okay, so that's an example of that formula in action. How are we going to do this for our multipole expansion? Okay, so write the words multipole expansion again. And we have a formula for phi, namely it's 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught add up. And we might as well talk about this being a volume charge density, although it could be any of the other ones just as well. So that's the little bit of charge, and then I want to divide that by r minus r prime. So what I need is a formula for r minus r prime, and I'm thinking about this for r bigger than r prime. So say I have a charged elephant, I'm interested in what the voltage is outside of that elephant, where my distances are big compared to the size of the elephant. Okay, so r minus r prime, how do I get the magnitude of that vector? Well, one way of doing it is to dot it with itself. That would give me the magnitude squared, and then take the square root of the result. Right. So what I've got then is r dotted into r, which is just r squared. In terms of cross terms, I've got minus 2 r dot r prime, and I've got r prime squared. All that to the 1/2. Now remember, if I'm going to use my Taylor series expansion, I want to have this as the form of 1. So these terms are successively smaller, right? R is big, r prime is smaller, r prime squared is going to be smaller still. So let me pull out r from this formula. So then I have a 1, and I've got a minus 2. So I've got an r squared in the denominator, and I'm going to write that as r hat dot r prime all over r. And then my final term is going to be r prime squared over r squared. Okay, so here's my 1. So what x is going to equal is 2 r hat dot r prime divided by r minus r prime squared divided by r squared. And the integral I'm trying to do is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, add up the little bit of charge. I've got my r there, and then I've got all of this stuff, which I'll just write as 1 minus x, to the 1/2. Okay, so in this case, what we have is x is x, and alpha, it's 1/2 here, but it's minus alpha in the if it's in the numerator, so alpha is going to be equal to 1/2. And what we have here then is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught integral of rho d v prime, and I've got an overall 1 over r, and then I'm going to have a 1 plus alpha times x plus the shifted factorial, 2 factorial times x squared plus lots more terms. Okay, so let's concentrate on that stuff that's in square brackets, bringing back exactly what x is. So what's in square brackets was 1 plus 1 half of 2 r hat dot r prime divided by r minus r prime squared divided by r squared. And then I've got plus 3/8 and then 2 r hat dot r prime divided by r minus, I'm running out of space, squared, square bracket. And of course there are an infinite number of terms there. Now what I'm going to do is to reorder these terms according to their size. So this term here is of order r prime over r. By definition, that's small. The next term, though, is like r prime over r squared. So that's smaller still. This term here, when it gets squared, is also of order r prime over r squared. The cross term between those two is going to be like r prime over r times r prime squared over r squared. Is that clear? Right? Because the cross term is going to be between this and that. So here I have 1 r over r prime, and here I have 2 r over r primes. So it adds up to 3. And finally, I would have this term squared, which would be even smaller still. So let's put together terms that have the same power of r over r prime, that are equally big or small. So I've got then 1 plus r hat dot r prime divided by r. That's the only term that has magnitude r over r prime. And then I've got additional terms. So I've got this term squared. So the 2 squared is going to be a 4. So that's going to give me 3 halves of r hat dot r prime divided by r squared. And then I've got minus 1 half of r prime over r squared. Okay, and I could do more terms if I was really interested in doing more terms. But we'll call it quits at that point. Okay, everyone's good so far? So we have made an approximation that r prime, that we're outside of the charge distribution basically, and we've put together terms that have the same size in terms of r prime over r. And now we have to just put those terms together in order to take a look at what our integral is. So getting back to what phi is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. It's always been that. And then we have the integral of the charge density dv. And we have an overall 1 over r that comes from that. And then we've got all of these terms. Right, so we've got 1 plus r hat dot r prime over r. And we've got that final term, which I'm not going to bother to write. And we've got infinitely more to calculate. Okay, so remember that r is our observation point. It's a constant as far as this integration is concerned. So for this first term, we can pull everything out of the integral. And we're just going to have then the integral of rho dv. So that first term is just going to be 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, the total charge divided by r. Right? So if we're a great distance from our elephant, the electric field is just what you would calculate for a point charge that had that same charge. But they're going to be correction terms. So what's the next sort of correction term we've got? Well, remember the r is constant, so I can pull it outside of the integral. R hat, whatever it is, it doesn't depend on position, so that's also a constant. So what I'm going to have is r hat divided by r squared, and then I'm going to have the integral of rho dv times the r prime vector. Okay, and that term should look vaguely familiar to you from mechanics. That was how you calculated the center of mass of an object. Yes? You added up the masses times the distances, and then you divided by the whole mass to get the actual location of the center of mass. We don't want to divide by the whole charge because the whole charge might be zero. So dividing by zero sounds like a bad idea. Okay, so this quantity here, it's a pretty simple integral, right? There's nothing square rootish about this. This is just a polynomial that we're integrating. That thing is called the electric dipole moment. And I hope you can see that it has the units of charge times length. Oops, and it's denoted by the letter P, which unfortunately can look a lot like rho. That's a lowercase p. Okay, so first order approximation is the elephant is just a point charge. The second order approximation, we have r hat dotted into this constant vector divided by r squared. What's this last term that we've got? Well, let's write it down, I guess, first. So the integral we need to do for this last term, so here's the term that we're caring about. So what we would have is the integral of rho dv, and then we would have 3 halves r hat dot r prime. Yeah, I think I'll call it quits there. Plus 1 half r prime squared. And all of this would be multiplied by the constant 1 over r squared. Okay, so if this is the dipole, kind of no surprise, this is going to be called an electric quadrupole. Let's see how it's going to work itself out. So, back to mechanics. Who remembers the moment of inertia tensor? And diagonalizing the moment of inertia tensor to get the principal axes of rotation. And the diagonal elements were the moments of inertia.
I've heard those words.
Who remembers that they once heard those terms? Okay, so the first term was the term tensor. What's a tensor? It's a matrix, yes. So if we think about working our way up from 191, right? So we started talking about scalars like mass or temperature, and then we talked about vectors that had 3 indices. There were 3 things of them, like velocity or acceleration. So let's go one more, right? Let's have some more indices. So the next thing up is going to have 2 indices, and it's going to be a matrix, therefore. And so saying it again, the mass didn't have any x and y components. It was just a number. Then we had a velocity, which had one index on it. I could be x, y, or z. And now we're going to have a matrix, and I'll denote matrices like that, that have 2 indices on them, right? Square matrices. So they've got 9 components. So the moment of inertia tensor was something pretty similar to what we've got. You might remember that the off-diagonal elements were x times y sorts of things, and on the diagonal you had kind of x squared plus y squared minus r squared. The details don't really matter to us. But it was that, in fact, I'm pretty sure you did this, a 3x3 matrix where you had to integrate the density times those various coordinates, and you were very interested in the principal axes of that object where you choose a coordinate system where the tensor was diagonal. That is to say that the only components were when I equals j. Okay, so I claim inside this thing, I can see a matrix. I don't know about that. So there's one matrix, one type of matrices that is, kind of old-fashioned, but I really like them, and they're called dyadics. And they're kind of funny, and I don't know if you would have talked about them in mechanics or not. I'm maybe more of a fan of them than other people are. So I'm going to think about a matrix that looks like the following. So every term is just a simple product of the x, y, or z whether I get it right or not kind of doesn't matter. You get the basic idea. And let me remind you that that's kind of like what the moment of inertia tensor was, right? Remember I said that these off-diagonal elements, I could probably tell you anything about it and you would have to say, oh yeah. The off-diagonal elements of the moment of inertia tensor were simple products, kind of like that. So I can write this matrix in factored form. And what that means is if I do matrix multiplication, right, if I put some vector over here on the right, what I would do is be running down these rows like this. So if I had some C vector here, for example, in this matrix, and I do the matrix multiplication, what I'm going to get for the first component, right, everything has an AX in it, I'm going to get BX times CX, BY times CY, BZ times CZ. And if you think about it, M dotted into C is going to be the vector A times B dot C. So that matrix multiplication now just looks like dot products. Okay, so dyadics are matrices which have this product form, the product of two vectors, and they turn out to be pretty common features in various types of physics, and in particular, that's pretty much what we've got here. How can I see that that's what we've got there? Well, what we've got here is R hat. It'll be helpful if I don't write it out as a square, right? So I've got R hat dotted into R prime, and I've got R prime dotted into R hat. So that's exactly the tensor that is R prime sitting next to R prime, that matrix, dotted matrix multiplication with R hat on either side. Okay. Well, what's this guy here? Well, first of all, I can put in an R hat for free, right? Because 1 is equal to R hat dotted into R hat. So I can add the unit matrix in there and have R hat dotted on either side. I don't know, so maybe none of this helps very much, but let's kind of write out what the answer is going to be. So if I look at the matrix, the IJ component of the matrix, that is, I have this integral over all, and I'm going to take 3/2 of, I'm not sure what the best way to denote this is. I guess I'll use R. So I have the ith component of R prime, and I have the jth component of R prime, and I'm going to, I have a sign error. So if we go back here, notice that this is a minus sign. And I don't know how I did it, but I put a plus sign there. Okay, so then we've got minus the unit case Okay, so, I don't know, did you do Kronecker deltas in mechanics? Anyone know what a Kronecker delta is? Yeah, so Kronecker delta, famous dead mathematician Kronecker, is defined so that delta ij is equal to zero if I doesn't equal to j, and it's equal to 1 if I equals to j. So something like this, if you think about it as a matrix, it's 1 only when we're on the diagonal. So this thing here is exactly the same thing as the unit matrix. Okay, so this is exactly what I mean by the quadrupole tensor. Technically, this is the electric quadrupole tensor. And I'm going to denote it in the future by, maybe confusingly, Qij. And if we go back to our general formula for the voltage, 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, we had the total charge divided by the distance. We had the dot product of r hat with the electric dipole moment divided by r squared, and this final term we're going to have is 1 half r hat dotted into this quadrupole tensor divided by r cubed. And there are higher and higher order terms in this expansion. Okay, so our charged elephant mostly looks like a point charge, and we can go down this sequence to get a closer and closer approximation to what the voltage is. Oops, there's a 1 half here too. And these integrals, they're just polynomials. They're not ugly things with square roots. And the other thing that's good about them is once you've calculated them, you're done, right? So if we look at integrating, if we're not able to do the integration symbolically, if we have to do numerical integration, then different values of r would require us to do the integration again. But here, we can calculate this quantity, q, once and for all for our elephant, and then that's good for calculating the voltage at any old spot. Okay, multipole expansion. Charge on an object, electric dipole moment, electric quadrupole moment. Now, one of the properties you might remember about moment of inertia tensor is the parallel axis theorem, right? If you choose a different axis, you'd get different values for the moment of inertia tensor. And the same thing is true here in part. That is to say, if I choose a different origin, I'm going to get a different numerical value for the quadrupole tensor. But what is the case is that if all of the earlier values are zero, then the quadrupole tensor doesn't depend on location of the origin. So obviously the total charge doesn't depend on where you choose as your origin. If the charge is zero, the electric dipole moment doesn't depend on where you choose as your origin. If both the electric dipole moment and the charge are zero, then the quadrupole moment doesn't depend on the choice of origin. So that means that you can tabulate the electric quadrupole moment of a nucleus, for example, and put it in a book, because it doesn't depend on what origin you're using to define the quadrupole moment. Okay. Yeah, charging. So maybe a nucleus is a bad example. So maybe I should have said a neutron. So, I don't know if any of you went to the talk before. We had something that's kind of the reverse of what we're talking about here. So here, I'm trying to figure out what the voltage is outside of an elephant. The t- Pock was dealing with what are called ion traps. So what he wanted to do is have charges outside of his experiment and be able to control what the electric field is in a smaller region. So under these circumstances, the place where he's observing inside his apparatus is small compared to where the charges are. So it's the reverse expansion from what we're doing. But it all works pretty much the same way. We can talk about the dipole moment, the quadrupole moment, etc. We can use all of those sorts of terms to figure out an approximate value for the electric field inside this container. Okay, so bar magnets, for example, using to bend beams at Fermi Lab, they're often called monopoles, dipoles, quadrupoles. And what we're concerned about there is the field that's between the poles of the magnet, where the size that we're considering is less than the size of the sources. Okay, and we could go on forever. Quadrupole is about as far as I've ever had use for personally. So let's take a look at an example. So I showed you the Mathematica code in order to calculate the electric field from a charged ring. And charged ring turns out something that you can actually calculate things for, but the answer is in terms of complete elliptic integrals, which aren't buttons on your calculator. So it's a little bit trickier than it might otherwise be. How can we calculate things, at least approximately, for what the voltage would be at any old spot, or at least a spot beyond this charged ring that we're talking about? So let's talk about a charge per length for this ring that is lambda and a radius of the ring that is r. So what we're invited to do in order to calculate this quadrupole tensor is we're invited to, yeah, I think this is actually on this sheet. So we're going to want to calculate the integral of the charge density, but this is a linear charge density, right? So this is going to be a lambda dl, and we're going to be going around in a circle, so dl is just going to be rd, did I call it theta or phi? Looks like I called it phi. And what we're supposed to calculate here is for any particular component, 3 times the ith component, the jth component, and then subtract off on the diagonal r squared. Maybe I should prime all of those guys. And for this ring, of course, r prime is going to be equal to r cosine phi, r sine phi, and it's all in the z equals 0 plane. And I hope you can see one of the advantages immediately. For this calculation, I don't care what the value of r is. This quadrupole tensity is a property of the ring all by itself. So what I've got then, let's say I'm interested in the 1-1 component of this matrix. So what I want to do is integrate up 3 times r cosine theta. I've got two of those squared. X squared plus y squared plus z squared is always equal to r squared. And then I've got a lambda times r times d phi. Okay, so these integrals are pretty easy to do. What we're doing here is integrating all the way around a circle, and a shorthand that I hope you've heard before is that the average value of either trigonometric function squared is a half. Is that a familiar statement to you? So we could find the antiderivative of cosine. It's not all that hard. But roughly speaking, on average, cosine squared is a half. So all I need to do this integral is to take the average value times the range of integration. And of course, this doesn't depend on phi, so that's just going to give me a 2 pi straightforwardly. So once I've done the integration, I've got 3 r squared. The integral of the cosine squared, I've said, is 1 half times 2 pi. And the other term is just going to give me 2 pi. And all of this was times lambda and r. Okay, so r cubed and lambda are all common terms. Everybody has a pi, so let me pull out, let me actually pull out a 2 pi for reasons that'll be maybe clearer in a second. So I'm left with 3 halves minus 1 inside the integral. 2 pi times r is the circumference, and the circumference times the charge per length is going to be the charge. So this is going to be the total charge times r squared times a half. Okay? How about the off-diagonal elements? So how about, for example, q1 times q2? So delta of 1, 2 is 0, so I don't even have that term to think about. So this would be the integral of 3 times x, which is our cosine phi, times y, which is our sine phi. And I'd be integrating that all lambda r d phi. Okay, and I could integrate this, for example, from minus pi to pi. So do you all know that integral is 0 without thinking real hard about it? Maybe, maybe not. So this is maybe a good time to talk about even and odd functions. So even functions are functions that are the same on both sides. Now, what do I mean by both sides? Well, it depends on the context. In this particular case, I'm thinking of about phi equals 0, an even function is going to be the same for positive values of phi and negative values of phi. So cosine is an even function. On the other hand, an odd function is a function that is opposite on opposite sides. And of course, the main point is if I integrate an odd function on balanced range of integration, then there'll be as much positive area as negative area, and so I'm guaranteed to be 0. So this is even, this is odd. Even times odd is odd. This is a balanced range of integration, so this thing is equal to 0. How about q1, 3? So that would be the integral of x, which is 3r cosine phi, times z, which is 0. Right? Don't have to do any work at all. That's equal to 0. So all of the off-diagonal elements of this quadrupole tensor are 0. So another way of saying that is the principal axes of this quadrupole are the x, y, and z axis. And that's kind of obvious just kind of physically looking at it. Obviously, the z-axis is special, and then it doesn't matter what other two axes I take. They're all going to be equivalent. So from that, we can see that q22 has to equal q11. How about q33? So that would be the integral of 3 times 0, right? Because z's are going to be 0. And then I have minus Kronecker delta of 3 is going to be 1. So I have minus r squared. And then I have r lambda d phi. OK, so nothing depends on phi. So this integral is easy. We're going to have r cubed times lambda times 2 pi. And that's going, we can take one of these r's and that 2 pi to give me q. So that's going to be qr squared. So this matrix in the end is pretty simple. It's 1/2, 1/2, and I think I made a mistake. It's minus 1, right? Well, I guess I didn't make a mistake. There it is, minus. Okay. What's the electric dipole moment of this ring? So kind of an equivalent question to ask is, where's the center of mass of this ring, right? Because the equation is the same. So the center of mass of the ring is where? At the origin, right? So location of the center of mass is 0, so the electric dipole moment is going to be 0. So in the end, in our multipole expansion, we're just going to have, we're going to quit at quadrupole moment. I guess there are an infinite number of terms. But we're going to have this term here, which just says that the voltage looks like it's from a point charge. And we're going to have this term here, which says that, well, it's not exactly a circle. So as a result, the voltage is going to be a little bit higher in the xy plane than it is going to be at an equivalent distance on the z-axis. So let's work that out. So if we remember that the formula says we're supposed to take our fixed value for this quadrupole tensor and dot it into the unit vector that points at the point where we're trying to figure out what the voltage is, and we're going to divide that all by r cubed. Okay, so what is the unit vector? Well, the unit r vector in spherical coordinates is, oops, started out wrong, sine theta cosine phi, sine theta sine phi, and cosine theta. Now, incidentally, it gets tiresome to write that all out, so it's helpful to have kind of an abbreviation. So I'm going to abbreviate it about as much as I can. I'm going to just use the first letter to abbreviate things. So for sine, I'm just going to write S. Now I've got sine of theta and sine of phi, so I got to be a little bit careful. So I'm going to tilde things that are phis. I won't always use that, but boy, it saves a lot of time. 4 times faster than writing it out the other way. And as long as everyone knows, it's pretty straightforward. So what I'm supposed to do then is to take my quadrupole, right, which we've said is basically 1/2, 1/2, minus 1, and 0 every place else. And I'm supposed to matrix multiply it by this r hat vector. So how is this going to work? So you remember matrix multiplication, right? It's this sort of thing, right? Horizontal and moving along to the side. So what I'm going to get from in the x component from this is just 1/2 times sine times cosine tilde. And in the end, that's going to be multiplied by sine times cosine tilde. So what I'm going to get from that is the 1/2, the sine squared, the cosine tilde squared. And that's how it's going to work for the next term too, right? So when I pick this off, I'm only going to get the diagonal term, which is sine tilde. And that's going to combine with that term there. And finally, I've got minus c squared. So sine tilde squared plus cosine tilde squared is equal to 1. So this is going to be 1/2 sine squared minus cosine squared. I like to use cosines whenever possible, and I know that sine squared plus cosine squared is equal to 1, so I can swap sine squared for 1 minus cosine squared. So that's going to be the value that we have. So remember I said that in the xy plane the voltage is going to be a little bit more. So in the xy plane cosine is equal to 0, right? Cosine of 90 degrees is 0. So I'm going to get extra values for voltage under those circumstances. If I'm on the z-axis, if I'm on the positive z-axis, theta is equal to 0 and cosine of theta is equal to 1. If I'm on the negative z-axis, theta is equal to 180 degrees and cosine of 180 degrees is minus 1. But either way, cosine squared is 1. So then I'm going to have 1 half minus 3 halves. I'm going to have minus a half. So you can see that this thing is going to contribute negatively to the electric values when I'm on the z-axis, and it's going to contribute positively to the electric potential when I'm in the xy plane, when theta is equal to 0. And you have there on your sheet kind of the final value for the, so do notice that you should probably kind of draw a line that separates those equal signs from the answer in the end. Tried to squeeze it in a little bit, right? So what we have here in the end is, approximately speaking, the voltage for this charge ring is exactly what we would write down just thinking about it as a point charge. And then we have this additional term, which is going to be small as long as we're great distances from the ring. And if we wanted it more accurate, we could include more terms. I'm way over, right? I'm sorry. Oh, it's...
Yeah, that clock isn't even close. You've still got 10 minutes.
Weird. Okay. Okay. Oh, okay. So I got extra time. Okay, so this problem of the charged ring, it's barely solvable in Mathematica, but we do get an exact answer. But we get an exact answer in terms of functions that aren't on your calculator. And here we get an approximate value, which is going to be really good if R is, say, 10 times the size of the ring. This correction term is itself going to be pretty small. And the other thing we learned from all of this is that to some extent, information is washed out by the electric field as we move away from the elephant, right? So when we're up close to the charged elephant, there's a lot of details about how the electric field is going to behave. But as we get further and further away from the elephant, it becomes more and more fuzzy. And in the end, the elephant kind of just looks like a point charge, unless we measure 8 significant digits or something. Okay, so electric quadrupoles are about as far as I've ever found to be useful, but there's no reason you can't go further if you really want to. And in particular, often if you're dealing with things like traps, you're interested in higher order terms. So one particular case, which Kyle knows about, we're interested in having extremely uniform fields, precisions of parts per million or parts per 100,000. So we want to get all of these terms to be zero is inside an NMR, a nuclear magnetic resonance machine. Right? So when they were doing my back, they must have had the magnetic field uniform to parts per million. And that typically requires handling all of these multiples to high precision. Let's take a second to think a little bit further about atomic traps, which, I don't know, were any of you even at the talk? So maybe one person was at the talk. Two people were at it. Three people. Oh, okay. So we're not totally wasting our time. So the name of the game, if you're interested in atomic physics, is to have an atom and to be able to study it. So you need to be able to hold it someplace. And that's tricky, right? Because atoms are no different from pens. If you drop them, they're going to fall. So we'd like to have something that would trap this charged particle. And you might think about, if this is a positive particle, that I kind of want to put up a barrier. So maybe I'll put a positive particle there, a positive particle there, here, you know, kind of cage it in with positive particles. And maybe it would be possible to make it so this thing would just stay there. And it turns out you can show that that's absolutely impossible. There's no combination of charges that would allow for a charged particle to stay trapped in the midst of them. There's always a jail escape that would take that guy out. So you might have noticed that the traps that were being discussed the other day were not electrostatic traps. In order to have the trapping, he had to have the electric field depend on time in addition to position. And what he said is that by kind of having a rotating electric field, and it was actually a quadrupole rotating electric field that he had, under those circumstances, you can make a situation where a charged particle can remain, on average, in that position. At any given moment, there's a way out, but by the time it tries to get out, things have switched around so that the exit is now just a wall, and so it has to try another way. So changing electric fields allow you to trap charged particles, but it's easy to show. It's a quick proof that maybe we'll do, maybe not, that there is no such thing as an electrostatic trap. Questions? 3 minutes. So we've talked about Delta IJ, the Kronecker delta, right? Famous dead mathematician Kronecker. What's soon on our list is the delta function, the Dirac. So obviously Dirac's a great guy, he's a physicist. And we're going to be interested in this Dirac delta function. And it's kind of the continuous version of the Kronecker delta function. So if we think about I and J as being any old values, this is a function that is mostly equal to zero, except when I equals J. And the Dirac delta function, the way we're going to be using at least, it's going to have two parameters, I might as well call them x and x prime. And if x doesn't equal x prime, the Dirac delta function is equal to zero. Okay, so if I were going to plot the Dirac delta function as a function of x, better use a different color, there it is, it's always zero, except for one point. And what I'm going to claim is that it has the property that the area under the function is 1. Right? So if I integrate the delta function, I get 1. So evidently, it must be really high because it's really narrow and nevertheless has an area under of 1. Well, as you might imagine, the people downstairs don't like that. So they would insist on calling this a distribution. But distributions are pretty much the same thing as functions. The one thing that's special about distributions is you're not allowed to talk about them by themselves. You're only allowed to talk about them under the integral sign. So if we think about how that would work, if we have f of x times this delta function, this is mostly equal to zero. It's in fact exactly equal to the same thing as that, right? Because if x isn't equal to x prime, it's equal to zero, we got that. If x is equal to x prime, we might as well just plug it in there. So that means that if I integrate f of x delta of x dx, it's the same thing as the integral of x prime delta of x dx. And this is a constant, right? Doesn't depend on x. So I can pull it outside of the integral. And we've said that the area under the delta function is 1. So that's kind of how it works, right? So the delta function is the thing that when it's in the integrand, which according to the mathematicians is the only place it can be, what you get is just the function evaluated at the singular point of the delta function. So this sort of thing, I hope you can see, is perfectly designed to deal with things like point particles. So if we think about something like an electron, the charge density is 0 any place outside of the electron. The only place there's charge is when we're inside the electron, and approximately speaking, the electron is a point particle. So there has to be a total amount of charge in the electron, but it has to be in 0 volume, so there has to be kind of an infinite charge density. Now, whether that's literally true for electrons, it's certainly how we think about electrons, and it's certainly a pretty good approximation. So maybe we should really think about delta functions as having some, you know, very tiny width, whatever the size of an electron is. But it's going to be just as good to compress that width actually to 0 and think about them as being, of having exactly these properties. Okay, so that's what's up for next time. The reason we want to talk about this is we're trying to complete this triangle. Right, we've got the electric field, we've got the voltage, and we've got the charge density. We know how to go from charge densities to voltages by doing those integrals. We know that we can do a line integral of the electric field to get the voltage, and we know we can take the gradient of the voltage to get the electric field. So now we want to fill in the last blanks. Given an electric field, how can I calculate the charge density that's producing it? Given a voltage, how can I calculate the charge density that's producing it? In order to make those proofs, the easiest way to do it is through these delta functions. Okay, so apparently I still have a half hour, but chances are you would object.